From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with John Barth, one of America's leading novelists. His books include The Floating Opera, The End of the Road, and a new novel titled The Tidewater Tales. Also today, I talk with sports writer Larry Merchant. As boxing commentator for HBO Sports, Merchant has covered some of the biggest bouts of the decade. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Alexander Zemlinsky's The Mermaid. At the turn of the century, Zemlinsky was one of Vienna's most celebrated composers. Now his works are being rediscovered. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tackles the subject of sexism in language. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is writer John Barth. He's widely considered one of the most inventive and imaginative of American novelists. His 9 works of fiction include The Floating Opera, The End of the Road, The Sotweed Factor, Giles Goatboy, Chimera, and Sabbatical. Chimera was the winner of the 1973 National Book Award for Fiction. Barth's rich imagery and complex style have drawn comparisons with writers like Nabokov, Borges, and Beckett. Of his own skill, Barth has said, "There are writers whose gift is to make terribly complicated things simple, but I know my gift is the reverse, to take relatively simple things and complicate them to the point of madness." John Barth describes his new novel, The Tidewater Tales, as a 655-page maximalist novel about a minimalist writer. Its main character is a writer with writer's block. His wife is an oral historian 8.5 months pregnant with twins. For much of the novel, they sail around the Chesapeake telling stories to try to break his block while waiting out the end of her pregnancy. Like several of his novels, The Tidewater Tales is a book of stories within stories. John Barth is a native of the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where he now spends much of his free time. He lives in Baltimore and teaches writing at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to open with a reading from your new novel, Tidewater Tales. Would you read an excerpt from it for us?
Well, I'll be happy to, though there is a difference between fiction for the ear and fiction for the eye, and this is a novel meant to be read. Nevertheless, it is a novel about storytelling, and I hope that it's rhythms and cadences are the cadences of storytelling, since that's the thing I'm very fond of. The novel's divided into two main parts. There's the longest prologue in literary history called Our Story, which tells us how this not-so-young man and his not-so-young wife, both of them at the end of their 30s, happened to be in the middle of Chesapeake Bay in a little sailboat named, I'm sorry to say, Story, without an engine, she 8.5 months pregnant, involved in a kind of race between Genesis on the one hand and Apocalypse on the other, since they're worried about the world ending before their babies are born, maybe before the prologue ends. And then the main section of the novel called Our Stories, which we'll come to in a moment. Here's a little snippet from the prologue, Our Story, where the action really begins. The couple are sitting around. They know what their problems are, but the reader doesn't quite yet. And at one point, Catherine Sherritt Sagamore, the wife of the couple, says to her husband, Peter Sagamore, "Tell me a story." To Peter Sagamore's surprise, Kathy Sherritt puts a hand on each side of his rowing hand, stopping the action. They're out there rowing their little boat home, trying to. Then kisses the hand she has thus framed and says, as if she'd been waiting to be asked, "Tell me a story." "What?" "Story." "Can't." "A story," she insists to her friend's brown hand. "Tell me a story of women and men like us. In love for 10 years the way we've been, married for 2, 2.5. What I want to hear about in particular is their houses increase." "Their what?" "Houses increase." Kathy pushes hair back off her forehead. "Houses increase. Like there they've been. Healthy, happy, more or less successful, well enough off, in love and faithfully loved, the favorite of the bloody earth like us. And yet, in early middle age, with perfect freedom of choice and the world going to hell in a handbasket all around them, I mean stuff like nuclear proliferation, the U.S. economy rusting out, the natural environment clogging up, the national infrastructure crumbling away, no money to rebuild it, that sort of thing. In the midst of this, they break their behinds and disrupt their lives to bring an innocent kid on stage, maybe just in time to see the curtain fall. 2 or 3 innocent kids. What are they? Sentimental? Hubristic? Oblivious? Nuts? She rests her chin upon her frowning husband's hand and speaks now to his belly. I mean, don't they care that their kids could be atomized or caught up in the worst convulsions this country's ever experienced? Do they finally not believe what everybody says is almost certain to happen, since nobody's doing much to prevent it, probably couldn't do much even if they wanted to? Or do they think their genes are such hot stuff that any kid of theirs will ride the apocalypse like a hobby horse? Says wondering Peter, who has seldom heard his friend at once so calmly and so impassionedly eloquent, "Tell me more." "No," says Catherine to his chest. "Now you tell me, did they consider all these things just as we did and go ahead anyhow, figuring they'll pay the bill but not count the cost?" "Pay the bill but not count the cost," Peter marvels. "That's very well put, Kath. So use it in the story," she says. "Tell me all about it. Tell me their story as if it weren't our story, but enough like our story so that the gods of storytelling will take the helm and man the sheets and blow us and it to a harbor we never could have predicted." Boy, oh boy, Peter Sagamore's look is pained indeed. "Don't I wish I could."
That's great. It's my guest John Barth reading from his new novel, The Tidewater Tales. We are very interested in the gods of storytelling.
Yes, I am.
As your character describes it. And they tell stories within the novel, and you're very interested in the idea of the novel as having stories within stories. And I think the best symbol of that is Scheherazade, who you've actually written a novel about. To refresh our memory, before we talk about stories within stories, would you briefly refresh our memory about the story of Scheherazade?
Yes, it's the greatest of the frame stories that we have, I think, in human literature. The stories Scheherazade tells are, I think, less impressive than the story of Scheherazade, which every reader, which every listener, I'm sure, knows about, even if they've never read The Thousand and One Nights, because it's one of those wonderful stories that we all know, whether we've read the text or not. What could be more amazing than to write a story like that? Scheherazade lives in an unnamed oriental kingdom, the sultan of whom is a woman-hater because his wife has deceived him, and who resolves, everybody remembers, to take a woman to bed every night, a virgin to bed every night, and kill her in the morning before she can be unfaithful to him, the arch-misogynist. Scheherazade, a young woman who is the daughter of the Secretary of State and who knows all about this business, volunteers herself to her father's horror. And then what everybody remembers is that she beguiles the king for 1,001 nights by telling him stories which she never finishes the same night she begins them. She so charms the king that he says, "I won't kill her till I've heard the end of her stories." At the end of 1,001 nights, she's not out of stories yet, but she asks for a favor. The king says, "What?" She says, "Marry me for the sake of our children." Turns out she's had 3 children by him in this meanwhile. And he does, not for their sake, really, but for the sake of her stories, and they live happily ever after. To me, she's the tutelary genius of storytelling. We all, I think, certainly all professional writers, but in a way, all of us, I think, are alive only as long as we're telling stories to one another. How was your day? How was your life? Let me tell you about mine, etc.
Do you see Scheherazade as the metaphor for the novelist?
Oh, very much so. Not only in an age like ours, where we hear in some quarters that the novel isn't the vigorous animal that it was in the 18th and 19th century, so we may all feel that we're sort of terminal. But even before that, even in the great ages of written fiction of the novel, even then, no writer has ever been better than the next thing. I mean, it's not enough ever, and properly so, to have written 1 good novel, 5 good novels, as some of the 19th century novelists did, 24 good novels. You're still only as good as the next one. We live that way as professional writers, and I think as readers, we properly regard other writers that way.
Well, in the Scheherazade story, she is saved from death by being able to tell this long, never-ending story that goes on for 1,001 nights. Do you feel that your ability to tell good stories has saved you from a terrible fate?
Well, it saved me from silence. The fate that at least this writer hopes for is not a kind of tenure, which is what the king awards Scheherazade in a way, the relative tenure and stability of marriage. In our vainest moments, we may hope for a kind of immortality, that is, that people will be reading our stories when we're gone. But what we really hope to do from year to year and decade to decade of our professional lives is keep people reading our sentences. It's a marvelous and luxurious fate, after all, and therefore a delicate and fragile one, to be allowed by the world to do what you'd be doing anyway, and actually know that now and then people out there are not only reading these stories, but being entertained by them, being charmed and beguiled by them. Yes, we're all Scheherazades.
A lot of modern writers, and I'm thinking especially of experimental fiction writers, have abandoned the story. They abandon narrative form to just work on language itself. It seems to me what you've done is figured out an experimental form for the novel that has the story as a vital part of it.
Well, God knows whether I've done it, but it's certainly what I've attempted to do. The great modernists, Joyce and Eliot Pound and so forth, left us with a tradition by, let's say, around the time of the Second World War, the tradition in narrative writing that plot was not very important. In fact, that it was a kind of insufferable artifice. There's a sort of a hi-fi realism to that attitude toward literature. I sympathize with that. It's this point of view about literature that I cut my apprentice teeth on. But modernism in that aspect really is a bit behind us now. It's unquestionably the great impressive movement in all the arts in the first half of the 20th century. Some of us feel that that noble movement belongs to the first half of the 20th century. And those of us who are sometimes rightly or wrongly identified with the term postmodernist, those of us who are writers, may feel that what that consists of is not going back to the 19th century as if the first half of the 20th hadn't happened, you understand, but finding a way to have it both ways. That's my house motto, to have it both ways with these things, to write as cunningly and guilefully and I hope charmingly as one can on the level of the individual sentences and of structure, but at the same time to do what the great storytellers have always done, tell stories and charm readers with those stories. If we can't do that, it seems to me at this point in the century, we're missing the boat and then the novel and literature really would be in trouble. But a great many of us are, I hope, managing to do that.
You said you cut your teeth on the idea that literature should be moving away from story as the center.
It was often said, for example, oh, my distinguished fellow writer, John Hawkes, one of the American novelists whom I admire most strongly, is famous for a statement, made a famous statement a few decades ago, that he regards plot, character, and I've forgotten, and theme, let's say, as the natural enemies of fiction. You know, that's not a statement that Hawks would make today, and it's not a statement that I hope would ever make. You know, I think artifice in the sense of plot and of the kind of characters we associate with, interesting characters, colorful characters, these are the very meat of the art of fiction, I believe.
My guest is novelist John Barth. One of the things that you once said about literature, as a matter of fact, it was one of your slightly tongue-in-cheek great rules of literature, is that whatever else it's about, great literature is almost always about itself.
Almost always also about itself. That's quite so. It sounds a little tiresome when you hear it. You know, one more example of the self-consciousness that has plagued the 20th century in general and the modernist movement in particular. And that's true. We are in and out of the arts. We are a terribly self-conscious century, just as we're a media-conscious generation. It's inevitable that that would be reflected in all our arts, certainly in the art of literature. But what I mean is something that goes back way past the modernist movement, back to the very origins of literature, a kind of fascination that literature has had with the fact that it is words, that it is stories being told. We see it in Homer, who introduces the blind bard Demodocus to tell the story that Homer's in the middle of telling about the Trojan War. We see it in Shakespeare, in the Greek tragedians. They're always playing on the fact that this is a play. All the world's a play. All the men and women merely players, etc. That's the kind of awareness of itself that I'm speaking of. Nothing more tiresome, I hope, than that.
Your main character in your new novel, The Tidewater Tales, has writer's block, or what you describe as the legendary, the celebrated, the unspeakably tiresome writer's block.
Yes.
Have you ever had writer's block?
Not for more than a day or so, but that may be that that I'm in the habit of measuring my own literary output by semesters and by seasons rather than what we hear Ernest Hemingway used to do, writing on the wall beside the toilet in his bathroom the number of words he had written this year. I should think this would be bad both for your natural hygiene and also for your output. Peter Sagamore's writer's block is the kind of thing that ordinary writer's block when it happens.
This is your character, Peter Sagamore.
Yes, hero of the Tidewater Tales. He's not blocked in that tiresome way of just a writer's problem. If that was the case, I wouldn't be interested in him, neither should any reader be. No, he's a man whose problems, whose silence, have come from a number of different causes. He is an arch minimalist. You mentioned this early in our conversation. Minimalism, of the sort practiced by Samuel Beckett and echoed in a great many of our very best younger American writers, U.S. writers today, is an honorable aesthetic. The slogan that we get from Mies van der Rohe and others, that less is more, is an inarguable proposition. I'm by temperament happen to be a maximalist, and so I'm interested in that phenomenon. Peter has minimalized himself into a corner of absolute silence, but it's not only for literary aesthetic reasons. There are reasons that involve his involvement on the margins of some things that have been going on in Washington. It involves his anxiety about bringing children into the world, perhaps at the very edge of the apocalypse, a very understandable anxiety, particularly for somebody who lives on Chesapeake Bay, I think, when we're so close to the scene of the action where decisions are made and the targets loom large. He says he has seven various reasons for falling silent, and the novel deals with those.
Well, you've described yourself as a maximalist writing about a minimalist. And, I mean, not only is the book very long, but you really write some very long sentences.
They tend to go on a ways before they stop, don't they?
Well, I wonder if that's part of a discipline to you, too. I mean, if you... What's your interest in writing really long, well-crafted sentences?
Well, long novels, to speak to that first, are, of course, an enormous imposition on civilized attention, especially at a time of history when we're told from every quarter that the human attention span, even of lively, intelligent people, is not what it was in the 19th century, when both in their pleasures and in the other areas of life, people were trained for sustained concentration. Still, other than just the perverse that maybe makes me want to go against the grain, if everybody else is writing short, I'm going to write long. There is the inarguable truth that some things take a while to say. Now, the English language, that gorgeous language that I practice and privileged to practice, has lovely possibilities in the ways of structures that go on for a while. It also happens that I am the last kid on the block to compose with a fountain pen and not a word processor. And there's something about the flow of ink on the page, I think, that makes my sentences go on a way before I pick up the pen and put the period.
Well, it becomes almost acrobatic, too, don't you think, when you're working a really, really long sentence?
It is a bit like the juggler trying to keep 2 10-bins, 3 bowling balls, and an egg in the air at the same time, hoping not to get egg on his face, yes.
My guest is novelist John Barth. His new novel is titled The Tidewater Tales. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Novelist John Barth is my guest. His new book is titled The Tidewater Tales. Well, we've established how interested you are in storytelling, and I wonder if there are any terrific storytellers or gossipers in your family that you grew up hearing.
My father had the misfortune to be very hard of hearing, and like many deaf or partially deaf people, he made up for this by being a tireless anecdotist. I don't know whether these things get passed down in the genes. They certainly can get passed down through family situations. Since he couldn't hear us, he talked to us and he told us stories. And so I grew up certainly listening to lots of anecdotes. These were not fanciful stories. It was not my good fortune to have the experience that an Indian writer friend of mine, Salman Rushdie, the Indian expatriate British novelist, said he had growing up in Bombay. His father told him and his siblings bedtime stories from the Arabian Nights, and the kid thought his father was making up these stories. That's a lovely beginning for a writer. My father's stories were about people on the Eastern Shore, people whom he'd met that day in his daily rounds, and he told them awfully well.
Did you were you verbal as a child?
Was I verbal? I was twins. Had the interesting fortune to be twins. I'm half of a pair of opposite sex twins, and my twin sister and I, like many twins early in our lives, found that we had a language that was hardly language. I mean, language was almost unnecessary among them. I think I probably got verbal when I went to school. Then, when you're not with your twin and you have to start talking to other people, one becomes verbal. Maybe more verbal for not having begun that way.
When did you start writing?
I started writing fiction in a kind of serious way when I was an undergraduate at college. I just stumbled into it. I didn't go there to be a writer. I'd wanted to be a musician. Didn't work out.
A jazz musician.
Hadn't the talent. A jazz musician. Went up to Juilliard from high school to study orchestration, but I played jazz drums. Found I hadn't the talent. Came home and had to scratch around for the next thing. thing to do. Went to college and had the good luck to fall into the hands of a splendid Spanish poet, Pedro Salinas, with whom I read Don Quixote. And the introduction was not just to the first living poet writer I'd ever met. He was an exile from Franco Spain, but to what remains one of my four favorite narrative works in all literature, Don Quixote.
So you went from jazz drumming to writing.
Jazz writing.
So you went from one art to another. You knew you weren't going to go into textiles or business administration.
That's true. There is such a thing as vocation, I realize, and he or she is lucky who has it, whether that means you've got the talent or not, which is quite another subject. I found in the case of music, for example, that while I was enormously interested in it and had a little bit of ability, I didn't have that vocation. I didn't have that sense that this is exactly what I'm going to do, whether I do it well or badly. And I found by a kind of backdoor or sidelong movement that was the case with writing. I knew after my first year of doing it in college that was what I'd spend my life doing, whether I got anywhere with it or not. That, I suppose, is what vocation consists of. God knows, as in most arts, it's certainly full of discouragement, and that doesn't stop. I mean, there are always people willing to tell you you should have stayed with jazz drumming or whatever.
Did you have a hard time convincing your parents that this was your vocation and you're going to follow it?
Not at all. I was in the enviable position. At least I envy it when I see the opposite among some of my own students and coachees, I would call them, at Johns Hopkins. The happy fortune of having parents who were not – these were the Depression years. They were the children of first-generation immigrants. They didn't have the privilege of going to college, and they were delighted if any of their children finished high school. So there's a kind of wonderful freedom in that. If I had told them I was going to be a metaphysician or a court poet, I think they would have said, well, gee, that's nice. We'll do whatever we can. And they did.
You got a scholarship to go to Johns Hopkins University.
Yes.
And you were from a working-class background, and it's a very expensive school, and usually people come from the finest educational backgrounds and comfortable families to go there. Did you feel uncomfortable? Did you feel out of place?
Well, I think given my own background growing up in the Tidewater Marshes in a quite small town, not a deprived background, but not what in today's jargon we would call an enriched background, certainly. We didn't feel that we were deprived, at least. But we certainly didn't have the access to literature, to the arts, to civilization generally that products of a good private school would have. At that point, I think I would have felt on an alien planet being anywhere else at all. And yes, that's the way I felt in my first couple of undergraduate years at Johns Hopkins. I would have felt the same, I think, in any good school. I would have felt the same simply moving to the city. So that was no big deal. At the same time, I loved it. And though I had the sense that I would never catch up, I soon understood that I would at least do my best to give them a good race.
Well, did that make you feel frantic or excited? Let's face it, you'd spend so much time as a jazz drummer, you weren't reading the great classics or anything.
And true. And there
and
was
Hopkins more than other places, I think.
Yeah, they had a rigorous
Yeah, you really have to be very well
background.
Versed.
In those days, one was expected not to be versed, but to become versed in the classics of the history of ideas and literary classics as well. Splendid introduction to them to come in at that level. I was both intimidated and inspired. And finally, I think the enthusiasm won out over the intimidation, especially because I soon found that writing was what I wanted to do, and that's not basically an intellectual enterprise, though it's not removed from the general intellect. And I was still playing jazz drums weekends, which was a kind of way of touching base with something more familiar and with which I could relax.
You are now teaching at Johns Hopkins, where you
Yes.
went to school on a scholarship. Do you ever see students who remind you of yourself?
Now and then in the respect of students with a lot of steam in their boilers, but not a lot of polish yet, diamonds in the rough. Sometimes they turn out to be rhinestones in the rough, along with the diamonds in the smooth. It was a pleasure to come back there after 20 or 25 years of teaching up north away from my beginnings. The place you come back to is not the place you left. It changes, and you have changed at the same time. The students I choose for our advanced courses in fiction writing at Hopkins, I'll say, are of a level of proficiency so much better than I was at their stage that I understand, like Groucho Marx, that he said he would never belong to a club that would have him for a member. I could not have been admitted to the seminar I now coach, but that's a happy feeling.
My guest is novelist John Barth. And I think it was 1964 you were writing about the tragic view of life in an essay that you did.
I still subscribe to it.
Okay, well, you wrote, the tragic view of life is that the human condition is essentially ironic and technically absurd. And I think it's fair to say that your first novels certainly had that as their theme. Do you still subscribe to that, and do you think that it's still the theme, finally, of your novels?
The tragic view of life, which is that that there is finally no settling of scores, that there is no great redress of injustices in some golden hereafter, I'm afraid I do still subscribe to. But I don't regard it, as I perhaps did as a young man when I was writing those first novels, I don't anymore regard it as a particularly gloomy view. It was infected with a kind of innocent nihilism in the novels I wrote in my 20s, which I have outgrown, perhaps simply because I relish life itself more as I get older. That's not such an uncommon pattern. Not gloomy at all. When Peter Sagamore and Catherine Sherritt, the hero and heroine of the Tidewater Tales novel, speak of the tragic view of everything from the CIA to the writing of literature, there's nothing hopeless in their feeling. No, on the contrary, the name of the game is to work with some spirit and enthusiasm without deluding yourself that you're finally going to make an enormous difference in the world, or that somehow everything's going to come out all right, because in general I think it does not. But that's not an argument for quietism, or certainly not for defeatism. The Greek tragedians understood that, and in my modest late 20th century way, I feel that too.
Is this worldview that you've applied to life and literature your kind of substitute for religion?
Well, it certainly has for me the force of a kind of religious belief, with the famous difference, of course, that it doesn't lead to any particular object of worship, only, I think, I hope, a kind of pleasure in, rejoicing in, celebration of, and crossing your fingers about life, civilization, and the future of the arts and of you. In my view, modernism shifts to postmodernism in literature, for example, at about the time when many people of my generation, like myself, stopped worrying about the death of the novel and began worrying about the death of the reader, all the readers, civilization in general. That, for me, would be the benchmark of the postmodernist spirit. We get over some of those earlier, rather more academic preoccupations into things that I think are much larger, richer, and more troublesome preoccupations. I'm much more worried about what's going to happen to readers who read literature and love literature, then what's going to happen? Who cares, finally, what happens to a particular little mode of literature like the novel? I hope it dies a nice, long, happy death, which it's been doing for hundreds of years and may for hundreds of years yet, if the world doesn't end first.
One final question. When you're reading for pleasure, do you ever read pop novels of any form? Or genre novels of any kind?
No, I'm afraid I don't. Now and then, mainly to do homework, for example. If the CIA is going to put its unsavory finger into my fiction, I'll go read a few CIA exposés, but also a few knowledgeable spy novels like John le Carré's, for example. And I find, God forgive me, that I can't enjoy even the good ones. There's something about that medium, and perhaps about pop literature in general. Then I remind myself, though, that Homer was a popular writer, that Dante was a popular writer, that Cervantes was a bestseller. And we're reminded that in some fortunate periods, anyhow, it's possible for a great writer to have it both ways in that sense as well.
Do you feel like you have?
I feel like I feel as though I can imagine no fate better. No, I don't feel that I've achieved that memorable objective yet. That's perhaps what keeps me going. But I can't imagine a better goal than that.
John Barth, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. You're quite welcome.
John Barth's novels include The Floating Opera, The End of the Road, and The Sotweed Factor. His latest novel, The Tidewater Tales, is published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Leanne Hansen will guest host the next edition of Fresh Air. She'll speak with actor George Hearn. On Broadway, he starred as the murderous barber in Sweeney Todd and as the flamboyant drag queen in La Cage aux Folles. He's currently starring in an off-Broadway production of Chaim Potok's The Chosen, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, sports writer Larry Merchant talks about the changes in the ring and in the sports pages. Merchant was sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and the New York Post. For the past decade, he's been boxing commentator for HBO Sports. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recent recording of Alexander Zemlinsky's tone poem, The Mermaid. The release is indicative of a renewed interest in Zemlinsky, who at the turn of the century was one of Vienna's most celebrated composers. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the dilemmas of sexism and language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. FBI officials say a gun was found today on the muddy California hillside where a Pacific Southwest Airlines jet crashed on Monday, killing all 43 people aboard. The FBI also says an analysis of the plane's flight recordings shows someone entered the plane's cockpit shortly before the crash. News reports have quoted unidentified sources as saying a fired U.S. Air employee smuggled a gun aboard the plane with the intention of killing his former boss. Just before the PSA flight went down, the pilot reported gunfire on board and smoke in the cockpit. The FBI says a criminal act is the suspected cause of the crash. President Reagan met with Soviet General Secretary Gorbachev for 2 hours this morning. Part of that time was spent at a private one-on-one session in the president's study with only interpreters present. More from NPR's Brian Naylor.
It was a day of heavy lifting, in the words of White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater. The two leaders discussed more specific issues than in yesterday's general sessions, including Afghanistan and the Iran-Iraq war. Arms control also came up, particularly the START treaty to reduce the two sides' long-range missiles. Fitzwater said both leaders were pleased with the favorable worldwide reception given to yesterday's signing of the medium-range missile accord and feel that it is a turning point in U.S.-Soviet relations and that the two sides should not lose the momentum in the search for lasting peace. There is an indication the two sides are making progress on the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan. Fitzwater said Mr. Gorbachev gave a hopeful sign this morning when he told reporters he was going to talk about specifics with the president. The Soviet spokesman, Gennady Gerasimov, said that meant not only a withdrawal timetable, but also included U.S. aid to the Afghan rebels. I'm Brian Naylor at the International Press Center in Washington.
Earlier today, Gorbachev met with congressional leaders who presented him with a long list of concerns. Democratic Senator Alan Cranston said the meeting went well.
We had a long and very friendly and remarkably, stunningly frank discussion with Mr. Gorbachev. Every member of the delegation for the House and Senate spoke. He was the only one who spoke from the Soviet side of the table. No American who spoke against the treaty. All sounded favorable to it, some very strongly.
One senator who is very strongly opposed to the treaty is Republican Malcolm Wallop. Today, Wallop demanded that the Reagan administration release what he termed a classified protocol in the accord, but administration sources say the 100-page document may never be made public because it contains the locations of facilities which the Pentagon fears might become the target of terrorists. At least 43 people were killed, including Peru's championship Alianza Lima soccer team, when their military plane crashed into the Pacific Ocean near Lima's international airport. Mike Reed filed this report for the BBC.
The plane, a Fokker F-27 jet of Peru's Naval Air Service, crashed into the Pacific Ocean just 6 miles short of Lima's international airport. The pilot is the only person known to have survived. Six bodies have so far been recovered, according to Mr. Agustin Marino, the president of the Alianza Lima Football Club. There has been no official word regarding the fate of the remaining passengers and crew members. A search was continuing, but there appeared to be little hope of finding any more survivors. A spokesman for the Peruvian Sports Institute said that 16 footballers were on the plane, as well as six members of the club management, including the trainer, and eight supporters. A referee and a linesman are also said to have been on board.
Mike Reed reporting from Lima. For the third time this week, the stock market has had an impressive gain. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 34 points to close at 1902.52. Advances led declines 11-5 in very heavy trading. This is NPR in Washington. I'm Sharon Green.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of the first recording of the complete score of The Mermaid. It's a long-forgotten work by the Austrian musician Alexander Zemlinsky. When Zemlinsky died over 40 years ago, his work had already slipped into obscurity. At one time, he had been a tremendous influence on the composers of the so-called Viennese school of 20th century music. But Lloyd says Zemlinsky remained a musical conservative, never abandoning melody and tonality.
Alexander Zemlinsky, or von Zemlinsky, was one of the most notable musicians in turn-of-the-century Vienna, conductor, composer, teacher. He was Schoenberg's teacher, and later his brother-in-law. He conducted the world premiere of Schoenberg's Erwartung. Berg's lyric suite is dedicated to him, and even quotes one of his themes. Alma Schindler, before she married Mahler, Gropius, or Werfel, was one of his protégés. But when Zemlinsky died in 1942, in Larchmont, New York, at the age of 71, he was virtually unknown. A handful of recordings over the past decade have brought him some new attention. The latest is Die Seejungfrau, The Mermaid, an ambitious three-movement orchestral tone poem over 40 minutes long, based on Hans Christian Andersen's story about the little mermaid who sacrifices herself for love of a mortal. Zemlinsky himself conducted the first performance in 1905, along with the premiere of Schoenberg's Pelléas and Mélisande. Between 1907 and 1984, it completely disappeared. Early this year, the Cleveland Orchestra played the American premiere of Zemlinsky's own 25-minute abridgment. Now a recording of the complete score has been released on the London label, with Ricardo Chailly conducting the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra. The Mermaid is an appealing work, more like Mahler than Schoenberg, sometimes more like Richard Strauss than either, like a Strauss version of Scheherazade, with watery sea themes, shipwreck music, and even a solo violin representing the heroine. Zemlinsky's orchestration has the gorgeous palette, but not the inspired energy of Rimsky-Korsakov. Yet underlying the glamorous surface is a pervasive melancholy and seriousness. The Mermaid is really about longing to be human, about unrequited love for the world. Here's an intricately woven passage from the second movement. The alternating themes depict the mermaid yearning for the prince she loves, his wedding dance, which she watches in pain, and the ocean itself crying its warning.
Mm-hmm.
Zemlinsky's Mermaid can sound a little slick at times, almost like movie music. But in the density of its ideas and textures, maybe it's just what more movie music should have turned into. I am sure that I lack a certain something that is needed, today more than ever, to get to the top, Zemlinsky wrote to Alma Mahler in 1930. It's not enough to have elbows. You have to know how to use them. This Zemlinsky album concludes with another rare piece, written in 1935 and not performed till 1971, nearly 30 years after his death. It's Zemlinsky's stark and haunting choral setting of the 13th Psalm. How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a London recording of The Mermaid by Alexander Zemlinsky with Ricardo Chailly and the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra. This is Fresh Air. Larry Merchant started his career as one of the new breed of sports writers, bringing journalistic and literary gifts to the sports page. At the age of 26, he was made sports editor of the Philadelphia Daily News. Then he moved back to his hometown, New York, to write a column for the Post. After 15 years as a columnist, he was reminded of something John Crosby of the Herald Tribune once said: if you've written a column for 15 years, you're going to start repeating yourself. Now Larry Merchant does sports analysis for HBO. He provided the commentary for the Marvin Hagler-Sugar Ray Leonard fight, which HBO will rebroadcast next week. And he'll also co-host an HBO special with heavyweight champion Mike Tyson called Boxing's Greatest Knockouts. Merchant has followed boxing for years, and he thinks its place in American life has changed.
Boxing is no longer a part of the social fabric of the country. That is to say, there was a time when there were a great many athletic and social clubs in every community, and particularly in major cities, and that boxing, amateur boxing, was a part of it. Today, there are pockets of that exist in major cities and occasionally in smaller ones, but it no longer is as broad-based as it was, and that it continues largely as a television show.
Why do you think that's changed so much?
Well, I think that other sports took hold professionally. I think there were social changes that came about in the sense that it became, as it always was, a sport dominated by the underclass. And when the underclass was white, which might have been primarily immigrants who were Irish and Italian and Jewish and so on, it was more popular among those people. When it became predominantly black and Latin and the still underclass, it lost some of its appeal.
When you're watching a fight that you're commenting on for broadcast, do you ever flinch or turn your head or feel like, oh, gee, I don't want to see this? Has that ever happened? It's probably a really naive question to ask from someone who's obviously an unseasoned viewer, but has anything like that ever happened to you?
Well, I think it's a good question, and as a reporter, I have to tell you that sometimes the most naive questions are the best questions, and I've been known to ask a few in my day. Yeah, I have seen fights when I have said on the air, this thing should be stopped. There is nothing left to prove. The man being defeated is has shown his courage, but he can't win the fight and that we should stop it. In fact, it's my feeling, and I think this is something that's coming into a sort of common law practice, that when a fighter is losing a fight by a wide margin, and it's apparent that he doesn't have enough punch to end it in some sudden dramatic way, and he is absorbing a lot of punishment, that I think that referees should be more willing to stop those fights, even though the fighter appears to be able and willing to go on.
You've written a lot about Muhammad Ali back when you were writing for newspapers, and you wrote that he really changed the way boxing was played. How was it different after Muhammad Ali?
Well, for one thing, boxing on television was more or less moribund until Muhammad Ali came along. And Muhammad Ali sensed that there was a connection between boxing and show business, and he was probably the first modern athlete that did and knew how to exploit it by being outrageous. So he had a profound impact on the game and as well on how much money that fighters could earn, because fighters have earned into eight figures, which is to say $10 million or more since Ali, and the income that a fighter can make on the very top level is just something totally out of sync with anything that ever happened before in boxing or sport.
I'd like to pull back a little bit and ask you about your career as a sports writer. You started writing for the Philadelphia Daily News in the 1960s. What was the year you joined the news?
Right. I joined the news in the late 50s.
Late 50s. Okay. Now, you are really part of a new school of sports journalists. What were some of the cliches in sports writing that you wanted to get away from? What did you want to do differently?
When I grew up, there were supposedly two schools of sports writing. There were the gee whiz guys, the cheerleaders who thought everything was wonderful, and there were the aw nuts guys, the guys who were cynical and thought that everything was fixed or corrupt or juvenile. There were, however, also a number of wonderful craftsmen as writers, from Ring Lardner and John Lardner and Red Smith and a bunch of others, and they were the ones who appealed to me as well as others of who were coming along at the time I did. And so we were interested in good writing and good reporting, and felt that sports writing should be as honored a profession as news writing or any other journalism.
This is a journalist as opposed to a fan?
I would say that's true, yeah. I think that for a very long time, newspaper editors and fans expected their writers to be fans of the teams that they covered. And they expect them to be angry when they lost and happy when they won. And they expected them to overlook anything that was wrong on or off the field. And our feeling was that, one, we wanted to be honest reporters, and two, that it was fun and games and not life and death, and that we should get down in the trenches and talk to the athletes rather than just sit up on high as theater critics.
You've several times acknowledged a debt to Ernest Hemingway. What do you think you learned about sports writing by reading Hemingway?
Well, I think that that all writers, modern writers, have a debt to Hemingway in terms of the clarity of his language. And sports writers had a debt because Hemingway was a man who covered losers. He wrote about the losers, not just the winners. And he wrote about them with compassion and understanding. So I feel that there's some debt to Hemingway in that regard.
You know, I know a lot of newspaper writers feel that the pay isn't always very good, and that in order to really get more pay, you have to become an editor or get into another level of management. Did that have something to do with you getting out of sports writing into sports casting?
No, it didn't. In fact, modern sports writers are paid on a level that I didn't dream of when I was a sports writer. There are sports writers making, the top sports writers today are making into six figures and having opportunities to supplement their income by writing books and so forth. No, I had just sort of burned out. And I had done some television work along the way, and television was starting to mature for me in the sense that people with my particular skills, even though I lacked any smooth broadcasting skills, could be used, and that it was all right not to just be a cheerleader, because television sports always felt it had to cheerlead, much as sports writers used to. So it was open for people like me, and now there are many others like myself who feel that that we can put things in a proper context, have fun with it, not look away from the downside, and yet still retain our enthusiasm for what games are about.
Okay, well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Larry Merchant's special, Boxing's Greatest Knockouts, premieres on HBO December 15th. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Usually at this time, you tell us what stories are coming up on All Things Considered. Uh-huh. But today, I thought maybe you could share some behind-the-scenes secrets about how the show's put together.
Here's a behind-the-scenes secret. Would you believe that when All Things Considered, 90 minutes of it, begins every day, as it is going to shortly, we have never, to my knowledge, in the 10 years I've been here, had the whole 90 minutes, the entire program, all edited, listened to, and ready to go at the time that the program begins. That's all going on after we start the program.
Well, there's probably a news story breaking as we speak, mm-hmm. So I'll let you go. We'll stand by and see how today's show turns out. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio. Ever since the issue of sexism in language was identified by feminists, many people have struggled to get their usage in sync with their politics. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some reflections on this contemporary problem.
Not long ago, I was writing a memo to try to get some students to help in running a conference we were holding at my university. I had just written, "We need students to man the registration desks," when I stopped in my tracks. Did I really want to say, "to man the desks," or was that just the English language talking? I was certainly hoping that the women students would cooperate as well as the men, and so I went scrambling for a synonym. Obviously, it made no sense to ask for students to person the registration desks. And if I'd asked for students to people the registration desks, I would have run the risk of encouraging lewd conduct among the undergraduates. After a moment, I came up with the obvious substitute: we need students to work the registration desks. And then, bathed in the glow of self-satisfied liberalism, I went on to write the next sentence: a total of about 10 man-hours of work will be involved. Then I sent the memo out without another thought. I tell you, it's a minefield out there. The grammar and vocabulary of English are strewn with expressions that reflect traditional preconceptions about gender roles. By now, of course, most of us have become self-conscious about some of these, like the use of man and mankind to mean humanity, or the great English pronoun dilemma. Should it be, everyone must pay his taxes, or everyone must pay his or her taxes, or everyone must pay their taxes, or what? But I'd never realized how widespread the phenomenon was until I came upon a little book called The Handbook of Non-Sexist Writing by Casey Miller and Kate Swift, which was published in 1980 by Harper and Row. I confess that it had never occurred to me before to ask whether there was anything sexist in referring to something as the largest man-made structure in the Western Hemisphere, or in saying that a candidate had a lot of appeal to the man on the street. Nor had I ever given any thought to the assumptions inherent in expressions like craftsmanship and brotherhood. So what's a fella to do? Miller and Swift argue that all these expressions reflect outmoded conceptions of gender roles, and that they all have to go. In many cases, they're surely right. It takes a certain insensitivity nowadays to say something like, these works appeal to the common man, when you could just as easily say the common person and avoid an ambiguity in the process. But as a matter of general principle, we don't always have to be slaves to etymology. We don't notice any contradiction when people talk about dialing a number on a push-button phone, for example. And people still talk about going to the five-and-dime store, even though they don't enter one without making sure they've got a couple of 20s in their wallet. For that matter, we're not shocked when a maid service sends over a man to do the cleaning. And we have no trouble referring to a temperamental male as a prima donna, even though the expression originally meant leading lady. By the same token, I don't see why we shouldn't be able to say that a woman has a real sense of sportsmanship, or that she has a good layman's grasp of economics. I guess I don't think of the word sportsmanship and layman as having any particularly masculine connotations nowadays, and I don't want to lose either of them because they have no exact synonyms. In the end, I suspect that most people stumble through the problem as I do, taking each word as it comes. As a result, it's likely that the English we speak 100 years from now will still contain plenty of expressions that bear the marks of origin in a male-dominated culture. I would guess that we'll still be using phrases like no man's land, unsportsmanlike conduct, and man-made. But I don't know that this matters so much, as long as we think of this residue as a collection of quaint reminders of the unenlightened times when our language evolved.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, guest host Leanne Hansen will speak with actor Josh Mostel, the son of the late Zero Mostel. After supporting roles in the films Radio Days, Matewan, and Compromising Positions, Josh Mostel is now starring in the off-Broadway comedy The Boys Next Door. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review A Very Special Christmas, the new record that features The Pretenders, U2, Bruce Springsteen, and John Cougar Mellencamp. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Last Emperor, the Bernardo Bertolucci epic set in 20th century China. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.